Okay, we're going to start with a little bit of poetry, for those of you who are that way inclined. See if you recognize it. Excuse me. The woods decay. The woods decay and fall. The vapors weep their burden to the ground. Man comes and tills the field and lies beneath. And after many a summer dies the swan. Me only cruel immortality consumes. I wither slowly in thine arms, here at the quiet limit of the world. Anyone recognize it? It is Tithonus by Tennyson. Okay, I'm an engineer by training, but I did English Lit at A-level for a break from all the maths, and I remember being absolutely captivated by that poem. In Greek mythology, Tithonus is the lover of Eos, the dawn goddess, and she grants him eternal life, but neglects to grant him eternal youth. And so Tithonus grows old and frail, but he cannot escape through death. And so the poem is his desperate lament as he envies happy men that have the power to die. And he pleads to be allowed to join them beneath the ground. He wants to escape from cruel immortality, which is eating him alive. So who'd want to live forever? That's our question for the next 20 minutes. And I think it's a really important question. Because many world religions hold out the idea of some kind of life after death as an essential part of their claims, and also as some kind of reward for those who follow that religion. So, if eternal life is impossible, then those religions must be wrong. If eternal life is undesirable, then they are extremely unattractive. Firstly, I'd imagine there's one great big rational objection to the idea of eternal life. So one big reason why we couldn't believe it. And that's that surely the idea of eternal life is just wishful thinking, nothing more. The very fact that so many unconnected world religions have some idea or some concept of eternal life seems to suggest there's something hardwired into our human brain. It seems we're wired to look for another life to enable us to cope with the difficulty in this one. So this life is hard, but it's okay, because the next one won't be. That kind of coping mechanism. But surely, as modern thinking individuals, we're past that. We understand that a desire for eternal life is an evolutionary instinct. It's our monkey hindbrain telling us that we need to go on living in order to ensure the good and the survival of the species. There is no soul, there is no spirit, there is nothing about us that is going to continue when this physical body ends. As writer Christopher Hitchens mused, I don't have a body, I am a body. And that's all there is to it. Eternal life is wishful thinking for which there is no evidence at all. It's not something that can be proved or even investigated by science, and so we should reject it. Now, if that's where you're coming from, I'm going to ask you, nicely, to put that aside for about 10 minutes. We're going to come back to it, I promise we are, but I think we need to look first carefully at emotional objections to the idea of eternal life. Not why we can't believe it, but why we wouldn't want to believe it. That's where we're going first. Because I think there's a case that can be made that even the concept of eternal life is bad news. Even if it were true, and you know, thank goodness for you, it isn't, it would be a very undesirable thing. And life is better, in fact, when we give up the pretense that it exists. Now, I think there are three important strands to that argument. And the first one I want to put out there is the idea that eternal life would be just insufferable. It would be awful. If you've seen Les Mis, then you'll know the song At the End of the Day. And in that, the working classes sing, at the end of the day, you're another day older, another day colder, one less day to be living. As we live longer, life gets harder. It seems that from youth we're on a downward curve towards death. And if you extend time off to infinity that way, it's going to bring more hardship and more suffering. Why would we want that? Two of the older members of my church died in the last month. And I can tell you that in large part for them, death was a merciful relief. Look at Tithonus, who I quoted at the beginning, granted eternal life but not eternal youth. And the result is that he longs to be mortal and to escape from this extended life. If life was just to continue downwards with age, why would we want more of it? Eternal life would be insufferable. Secondly, I think you can argue that eternal life would be senseless and valueless. I mentioned Christopher Hitchens. He was a brilliant atheist writer, speaker, and thinker who died of cancer in 2011. After his cancer diagnosis, he wrote his final book called Mortality, which I quoted from a minute ago. And in that book, he reflects that death is necessary if life is to have meaning. He compares death to the dark backing that you get on a mirror. He says, death is like the dark backing that a mirror needs if we are able to see anything. Without that, a mirror doesn't work. In other words, without a frank knowledge of our mortality and our limited lifespan, we cannot make sense of life. I read a piece by philosopher John Gray who picks up this point, saying that death is necessary for life to have value. He calls it the joy of transience. And this is a quote from him. He says, only creatures that live in passing time can know moments of undying value. There are no such moments in a life that can never end. In such a life, there's nothing to treasure, nothing that has value because it cannot come again. Our lives have meaning because they are bounded by death. And Gray extends the point to say it wouldn't just be senseless and valueless, but actually it would be subhuman. He takes the idea of life after death separated from a physical body, and he compares it to a human psyche that's been uploaded to a machine, a computer-generated phantom, a high-tech shadow. He says the shade might persist forever, but the individual, the human individual, would be dead and gone. Eternal life would be insufferable, senseless, and subhuman. And thirdly, I think you could argue that death is necessary if we are to live well now. In 2005, the brilliant and unique Steve Jobs gave the commencement speech at Stanford University. Before that, recently he'd had a brush with pancreatic cancer, which of course was what killed him. But here he describes the clarity and purpose which a knowledge of mortality brings. He says, death is very likely the single best invention in life. It is life's change agent. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to helping me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. So for Jobs, the knowledge of death was what drove him. It was what enabled him to live free from distraction and to focus on what mattered. If eternal life is untrue, then pretending that it is true distracts us from living well now. To quote the great and esteemed philosopher John Bon Jovi, I don't want to live forever, I just want to live my life. Surely that's better. Forget about the myth of eternal life and get on with enjoying this one. Or as Professor Dawkins says, be grateful that you have a life and forsake your vain and presumptuous desire for another one. Another esteemed philosopher, Albus Dumbledore in Harry Potter, says that you've never seen him quoted alongside these people, have you? To the well-organized mind, death is the next great adventure. And surely that's the summary of the matter. Death is, in a way, a friend who drives us to excel. Eternal life is unattractive wishful thinking that we need to put behind us if we're to be fully human and fully alive. Okay, that's why perhaps we wouldn't want to live forever. But give me a few moments, and I'd like to try and explain why I think that position leads us to some difficult places. And I'm going to start with a bold statement. If we lose a concept of eternal life, if we reject that, then we seriously affect our ability to live well in the here and now. If we reject the notion of eternal life, I want to suggest that we could do some serious damage to the foundations that we all require for normal human life. Firstly, we all want meaning. We want ultimate meaning in our lives. We want our lives and actions to have some significance. But the problem is we end. Everyone you help will end. Everyone you know and interact with and love will end and leave no lasting mark on the universe. You can change the world a little, perhaps, but then you end and you're forgotten. We pop out of existence along with all people until life in the universe is extinct. And save for a short legacy, perhaps of good or bad, my life and your life will make not one iota of ultimate difference to the universe. And if there is nothing else, then we have a real problem when we start looking for any stable or ultimate meaning to our existence. If nothing lasts, then nothing can have lasting meaning. Now, this isn't my idea. This isn't even a Christian idea. Professor Dawkins and the New Atheists follow the natural logic of materialism to a universe of electrons and selfish genes guided by blind physical forces and genetic replication. They're quite open. There's no meaning in that. Go back further. Jean-Paul Sartre wrote of the nausea of existence when you realize that there's no meaning in life. His character, Roquentin, struggles with the concept that I hadn't the right to exist. I appeared by chance. Or in The Stranger by Albert Camus, the protagonist, near the end of the book, suddenly realizes that the world has no meaning and that there's no God to give it one. Or Samuel Beckett, in his famous play that he wrote, Waiting for Godot, if that's pronounced correctly, in which two men wait endlessly and in vain for the arrival of this mysterious figure, Godot, who never comes. And it's a picture of the human race waiting, killing time, waiting, waiting for something or someone to come and give us meaning and give us a purpose, but they never do. Without eternal life, I just want to ask the question, where can we find ultimate meaning? So ultimate meaning, firstly, is eroded away, but I suggest that ultimate value is also something that we lose. What is ultimate value? Well, we have a strong sense of justice. Some things are right, some things are wrong. Genocide is wrong. Child abuse is wrong. And we believe our values should be adhered to universally and that people who break them should be punished. That's a sense of ultimate value. But if life ends at the grave, then there is no moral obligation. There's no accountability. And how you live is entirely up to you. And no one can tell you otherwise, and here's the key thing, with any authority that you have to accept. Dostoevsky wrote, if there's no immortality, then everything is permissible. So if Pol Pot got away with it while he was alive, then he got away with it. If the suicide bomber pops out of existence, then there's no justice. No eternal life means that gut-wrenching, nauseating evil goes unpunished. And it even means that there is no ultimate standpoint from which to judge those actions as evil. So what can we do if we lose those things? If we don't have ultimate meaning and value? Well, I think then we're forced to face the stark facts of life and to live bravely in the face of them. In the words of Bertrand Russell, we must build our lives on the firm foundations of unyielding despair. Now, I'd just like to ask, can we live like that? Can we really live like that, consistently and well and happily? I'd suggest that Russell is right. Being fully consistent with that conclusion leads to despair and doesn't help us to live well. So if we do want to live well, then we're forced to be inconsistent. We're forced to make leaps of faith to find value and meaning in a world where we know there is no ultimate basis for such things. If eternal life is wishful thinking, then I want to suggest that the search for ultimate meaning and value is also wishful thinking. Okay, so far I've shown why rejecting the idea of eternal life can be troublesome. But I haven't actually said, why would we want to live forever? Why would that be a good thing? And so for the rest of the time we've got, I'd like to focus on the Christian view of eternal life and put forward a few thoughts on why I think it's very good news. So the first part of that is that, the Christian worldview confirms that life is good and that death is an enemy. It confirms our natural response to the end of life. As I mentioned earlier, Albus Dumbledore advances the idea that death is not an enemy but a friend. something to be embraced and welcomed when the time comes. And I've got to tell you, that sounds fine, it sounds noble, until you stand at the grave of someone you love. We know somewhere that death is somehow wrong, or we have that kind of instinct against it. And there is nothing in humanist atheism that gives us any confirmation or backing for that at all. Christianity, on the other hand, does. In the New Testament, there's an account of Jesus at the graveside of a close friend. And he's not blasé about it, but you see him weeping. And he doesn't just weep. He snorts with anger and indignation at death. He's so angry and indignant that there should be death in the world. He sees it as an intruder, as an enemy to be fought and defeated. If we reject the concept of eternal life, then I think we're forced to deny one of our most basic instincts, that death is somehow an enemy. But the Christian view confirms that instinct as absolutely right. I'd also like to just briefly outline why I think the Christian beliefs about eternal life are a world away from the concept of eternal life you may have in your mind. And so many of the objections that I raised earlier actually are just shooting at the wrong target. So firstly, the kind of objections about the nature of eternal life. Isn't it subhuman, ethereal, disconnected, dull? You know, sitting on a cloud playing a harp doesn't sound like good news to me. Well, the Christian view holds that there is very significant continuity between the human life we experience now and life that is after death. It says that it's human life as an aware, thinking, feeling individual, capable of living in community, capable of conversing and learning and doing, growing and developing. It's not some kind of dehumanized or de-individualized experience, but fully human. Second, it's a physical human life with a real physical body, not ethereal, not disconnected. It's life with work to do in a physical world, to discover and to develop and to improve and manage, so it's not dull and cyclical. In other words, all of the good things that we enjoy and appreciate about life, in the Christian view, they continue. But as we said, continuity on a downward curve isn't particularly good news. So what we would need is a massive step change if eternal life was to be worth living. So secondly, there's not just continuity, but there is massive change as well. The Bible pictures a new world, a new creation, this world redone, if you like, remade, perfected, so that living in it isn't uncertain and difficult, but exciting and colourful and vibrant. A world where people are perfected so that life is better, so that human community is without injustice and without conflict and without inequality. It pictures a world where there's no illness, no injustice, no pain, no decay. A world where death, the enemy, is a defeated enemy. In the Christian view, life doesn't just continue. It doesn't get harder and harder. Rather, all those things are like a bad dream when you wake up, like the memory of them just fading. C.S. Lewis describes it as seeing the real object when all you'd seen was the shadow on the ground, or seeing the reality when all you'd seen was a reflection in a mirror, somehow more real, more human, more alive. The picture the Bible uses is one of God wiping away every tear from our eyes. If that were true, then I think it would be good news. Instead of the firm foundations of unyielding despair, it would give hope. It would give ultimate meaning to life as part of a bigger story written by one author, weaving all the narratives together. It would give ultimate value and say that what we do matters, that good is good and bad is bad. And it would free us, I think, to live better, not focused on self-preservation. It'd be good news. But going back to where I started, I haven't offered you any evidence at all. At best, I've suggested that the idea of eternal life may not be so bad, and the Christian view might even be attractive. But that's not evidence. Imagine for a second that you just didn't believe in Australia. You just didn't believe it. You know, it's a conspiracy by Google. They've put this continent on Google Maps. They've faked all the photos. What would convince you? I think one of the most powerful proofs you could be offered is if someone you knew went there and came back. If you had a friend who could say, yeah, I've been, it's real. And look, I brought you back a boomerang and a koala bear and the ashes. Maybe that's not really going to happen. If someone went and came back, that would be evidence. Well, as I close, the evidence I want to offer to you is the Christian claim that Jesus is the man who went there and came back. The man who died but was physically resurrected, and so can tell us about life beyond death. If that's true, then it's a real event which would have left markers in history. If it's historical, then it's something you should be able to look into and reach a conclusion about.